Good afternoon. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU. I am your co-host, Maria Gerard.
And I am your co-host, Esther Ann.
Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change here in the Dawnland. We will explore topics such as restorative justice, restorative practices, decolonization, cultural revival. Our guests are people who are involved in aspects of truth, healing, and change work, and this program is offered in an effort to share, inspire, and inform. Dawnland Signals is a collaboration of Maine Wabanaki Reach and WERU-FM.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Esther Ann, and today's topic is decolonizing our diets and food as medicine. And I'd like to open this topic with a quote. I've had the opportunity to reread Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, Braden Sweetgrass, and I just have a little excerpt from her book that I'd like to read. The Honorable Harvest asks us to give back in reciprocity for what we have been given. Reciprocity helps resolve the moral tension of taking a life by giving in return something of value that sustains the ones who sustain us. One of our responsibilities as human people is to find ways to enter into reciprocity with the more than human world. We can do it through gratitude, through ceremony, through land stewardship, science, art, and in everyday acts of practical reverence. That was from Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, Braden Sweetgrass.
So today we're going to have a discussion on food as medicine, decolonizing our diets, food security, and topics like that. But before we delve into the discussion and introduce our guests, let's just take a moment to acknowledge the land beneath our feet. The land of the first light, the dawn land, Wabanaki. Land that has known Wabanaki ancestors, the tallest trees and the oldest rivers. Land that has known peace and conflict. Land that has nourished us and sustained us since time immemorial. We acknowledge the indigenous people of this land, Wabanaki, the Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, and Abenaki. We are broadcasting from WERU Studio in Blue Hill, Alamoosuc, Wabanaki.
Thank you, Maria. My name is Esther Ann. I'm your co-host. And today the topic is around food as medicine and decolonizing our diets. And we have with us today two very special guests. First, we have Olivia Moore, who is a Penobscot Nation tribal member. She's also the co-chair of Maine Wabanaki Reach and the founder of Eastern Woodlands Rematriation. And our second guest with us today is Brian Altivator. He's a member of the Passamaquoddy tribe. He's the founder of Schoodic River Keepers, and he is the health and wellness coordinator for Maine Wabanaki Reach. I'm glad that you could both join us here today. So before we delve into thinking about decolonizing our diets, we thought it would make sense to talk a little bit about the colonization of our diets and the impacts and the other impacts of colonization on our people, Wabanaki people, and their well-being. And I thought, Brian, you could start and share some of your thoughts about that.
Okay. Hi, this is Brian Altivator. I remember my grandmother, they called her Gotlin, Kitty, Kathleen Altivator. She was a Dana before she got married. And she used to talk about the way things were you know, way back when she was young. She was born in 1898. And she talked about lobster being so plentiful that they used to load the lobster on wagons and everyone had a garden. Things were pretty plain and simple back then, but folks really helped each other. They helped each other a lot. The other thing too was that there was no causeway that ran through the reservation here at Sibayiga Pleasant Point. So everyone in the community was fluent in the language. And in 1955, they put the causeway, a road through the reservation and into Moose Island and Kalo Island, which is, you know, eastward. And when they did that, the simple way of life started kind of disappearing. The language started, I don't want to say vanishing, but all of a sudden English started competing with the Passamaquoddy language till it came to the point where, you know, it was a predominant language used. And many of our parents and grandparents were forbidden to speak the language in school. So getting back to the diet, a lot of our people didn't have a high sugar diets. There was a lot of fish, and they harvested, you know, whether it's dandelion greens or whatever. And it would depend on during the seasons as to what was available as to what would be harvested. And I never heard of anybody way back then, you know, according to my grandmother and some of the elders that are no longer here, speak of people that had diabetes and things like that. And so what would happen is if somebody was ill, they would gather medicines and herbs, you know, in the surrounding areas and treat people like that. Very seldom did somebody actually go to the doctors. All of the births were delivered by midwives, and people were, they were very poor around here. We didn't have much land base, so they had to utilize whatever was available. And, you know, my grandmother would say that everyone had a garden, you know, and they would hunt porpoise and gather different fish and stuff like that, that the bay provided here on the Passamaquoddy Bay, shellfish. And of course they would hunt porpoise and seal and some of the other fish species that are were very plentiful back then. And so, you know, it seemed really exciting. I used to love to listen to some of her stories and stuff like that. And it's like, it's the exact opposite now. You know, there were no fast food restaurants or stores around. And so they had to survive on what they could gather. And a lot of them would smoke the meat or the fish or salt it. And, you know, they would have to put enough away. Sometimes they would, can it. And they would hopefully have enough to last through the winter. And now that we have such a high, you know, sugar content in our diets, you know, we only have about 750 Passamaquoddies on reservation here at Sibayiga. Yet we have about 90 diabetics, which is incredibly high. The other thing that wasn't around a lot way back, we'll say in the 1920s, was a lot of alcohol. And we've got a lot of alcoholism on our reservation too. And so I went to the doctors here probably 3 or 4 weeks ago. And I have a doctor friend that I call every now and then. And I had a really nice talk with him. And I was prescribed this medication. And he said, make sure you research it before you start taking it. And so I researched it. And it what the research showed was basically the risks outweighed the benefits of the medication I was given. And so I went online, I punched in the name of the medicine that I was prescribed, and there were 15 ingredients in the medicine. One of the ingredients was a medicine. The other 14 were additives, from colorant to salt to sugar to you name it. Mm-hmm. And like I said, the side effects far outweighed the benefits. So I said, you know what? I'm not taking this. And so I went online and I ordered some stuff that you mix in with water, you know, is called Ultra Beats, and it's supposed to help you in many, many ways. And the other thing is, through the years, I've learned that there are different medicines, you know, available to us that you can use that will help, whether it's your blood, your digestive system, or whatever it may be, you know, in the woods. And unfortunately, this day and age, I think the average prescriptions per household in the United States is 7 prescriptions per month. Each household, that's nationwide. And, you know, I think we've become dependent on that. I mean, we've even got medicines for headaches, upset stomach, you know, you name it. And we've gotten away from that. And I think that with this COVID-19, we all know about that and what it's done to this country, what it's done worldwide. I've never lived through a pandemic that we're going through now. And I think eventually we're going to have to go back to the way things were many years ago. And we're going to have to rely on each other, help each other again. And I think we certainly have to change our diets because, you know, if we don't, the end result is not good. So that's enough for me on that.
Well, it's almost like needing to come around full circle again, you know, when we look at the effects of colonization on our diets, on our health care, on our well-being. And it's like we've taken this long path, and now we're coming back around again to reinvigorating traditional ways of knowing and being. Olivia, did you want to add your thoughts to that?
Yes, I'd love to. Thank you, Brian. I really appreciate the specific examples and some of the stories that you shared from your mother and grandmother. So in thinking about colonization of diets for Wabanaki people and for many Indigenous people, I really think of removal from land and the process that that was connected to removing us from land. You know, land for us as Indigenous people is a relative. It's the basis of, yes, our food systems and our healing systems. Land is also land and water, ways, earth is also the basis of our economic structures, our political and economic structures, and our spiritual grounding. It's the basis of like all of our ways of like knowing and being and organizing ourselves. So colonization, removal from land and removing the Indigenous original people from land was like step one of colonizing and settling our homelands. And so with that process came, you know, commodification of our land, the resources and labor bodies on the land. Colonization of our Wabanaki territory came with, you know, this framework of extraction and exploitation. And it also was a process, removing us from the land was also a process of harming the traditional leaders knowledge keepers and healers within our traditional social and political structures, right? We know that we were traditionally matriarchal here in Wabanaki territories. And so what that meant for the really key centered role of women, of grandmothers, of elders, of nurturing of our two-spirit relatives who were made invisible and violently erased from our important roles of healing and being knowledge keepers. So, you know, and it really comes back to this disruption of, so really disruption of our diet, disruption of our relationship to the land is kind of connected to all of the challenges and the struggles that we have, that our ancestors and we have undertaken, but we also have really beautiful gifts. And Brian was sharing many of those. And so as we're undertaking, so thinking from the lens of Eastern Woodlands Rematriation, a collective that I'm one of the co-founders of, we're a collective of Indigenous women and Two Spirits throughout the Northeast, what's now the United States, so throughout the Northeast, working to rematriate our food systems, to restore our Indigenous food systems. And so we're really centering the role of our matriarchal structures and what it means to rematriate to the earth, to our relationships with our human relatives, with our more than human relatives. So I really look forward to, I'm happy to share more about some of our, the ways that we're embodying that work as we continue in this conversation. But so restoring our diet means restoring our relationship to the earth, which again is the foundation of our spirituality, our economic, a balanced restorative economic structures of the Wabanaki people, and also balanced social and political ways of being that we honestly don't have in place right now in our tribal communities.
Yeah, I love that idea of restoration of relationship. And I also wanted to acknowledge the stories that Brian was sharing about the way things were and how stories are so often connected to our homelands, our place here. And, you know, when you're out and you're harvesting on the land and you're thinking about those connections, you know, when you're out on, say, one of the reservation islands and you're picking fiddleheads, you know, you might be thinking about how it came that these islands were reserved, how these, you know, have maintained your reservation islands and all the different stories associated with fiddleheads and fiddlehead picking in the past. And so it becomes, you know, this accumulation of stories and relationships. And I really love that you mentioned that. So in decolonizing our diets or looking at the effects of colonization on our diets, as was mentioned, it's our diminished land use and the dispossession of ancestral homelands. It's the damming of rivers and, you know, running causeways through, you know, the bay and all of these sorts of things that have disrupted our relationship with our food. And I wanted to mention just a little bit about some of the previous work that Maine Wabanaki Reach has done around this theme of decolonizing our diets. You know, we have had a wellness gathering devoted to this topic in the past, this topic of food as medicine. And we were able to work with some students at the Beatrice Rafferty School at Pleasant Point to put in a medicine garden. And that was a really great collaborative project that we did in community. And while we were teaching students about starting seeds and how to place gardens, they were teaching Passamaquoddy words for planting, and it was just a great relationship to build this garden together. And Reach has also done events at the People's Garden on Indian Island, the community garden there, a meet and greet with Robin Wall Kimmerer, and a lot of other different things around this topic of decolonizing our diet. So it's really an important topic for us. And one of the projects that we did in the past, we did with Skudik River Keepers. And Brian, you were very much involved with that. We did a history run in Calais as a collaborative with the Skudik River Keepers. And there we really talked about the importance of our fisheries and the fish as food. Did you want to talk a little bit more about that topic, Brian?
Yeah, thank you, Maria. This is Brian again. Thanks for what you said, Olivia. Well, you first started talking, I was thinking about balance, and then towards the end of what you said, you did mention balance a couple of times. So anyway, the St. Croix River at one time was called the Skudik River, and before that it was named Passamaquoddy River. And like Maria said, we had a history run, and it was done in the summer months. And the St. Croix River has as much history as any river probably in the Northeast. It's not as big as the Kennebec River, certainly not as much smaller than the Penobscot River. But what's interesting about the St. Croix River is it has the potential to have the sea run fish of alewives and blueback heron, which usually accompanies alewives up the river to spawn. Typically, for every 10 fish you see, go up the river, 9 of them are going to be alewives and 1 of them will be blueback heron. The alewives like water that's still. And the blueback heron is kind of like a salmon. They like swift moving water. As a matter of fact, the alewives are running up the rivers now. It's estimated that there were between 45 million and 60 million alewives going up the St. Croix River. And like I said before, the St. Croix River is a much smaller river than the Kennebec or the Penobscot. However, it has potential for its population to be more than the Kennebec and the Penobscot put together, if you could imagine that. And it's pretty sad that we have no salmon in the St. Croix River. And there are other sea-run fish that can't access the watershed in the upper reaches of the St. Croix watershed. And it's because of dams, it's because of pollution, inadequate fishways, and also they used to have, log drives, way back when. And it's still, in some places, yards deep on the river bottom of bark and sawdust and stuff like that. And so the water is kind of stagnant there. And so anyway, in 2002, at the Milltown Dam in Calais, there was only 900 fish counted going up the river. Last summer, after they opened the fishway, it's only been maybe 7 to 8 years since the Grand Falls fishway has been open. Last year at Milltown, they counted nearly 500,000 alewives migrating up the St. Croix.
And
they're decommissioning the Milltown Dam, and it should be taken out by 2022. So that'll they'll have unfettered access to the St. Croix for 20 more miles. And then next obstacle will be the dam at the mill in Baileyville. And after that, the big dam in Grand Falls Dam. Now, what a lot of people don't know, when they put that dam there, it's just below where the St. Croix branches off, you know, the West St. Croix goes through Big Lake, Indian Township, and up towards Dobsey. The East Branch goes, you know, is a international watershed. You know, you got the Canada on one side and the U.S. on the other. So when they built that dam, you know, well over 100 years ago, they flooded 4,000 acres of Passamaquoddy lands. And when they flooded that, there were some places that weren't islands that are islands now. And there were some islands that are underwater now because that dam is 50 feet high. I mean, it's really a ugly looking dam. And so, you know, we've been fighting to restore the fish, the alewives. You know, they say the alewives is a keystone species. It's they say it's the fish that feeds all. Because there are certain nutrients and minerals and other things that the alewives bring into the freshwater watershed that aren't in the fresh water. They go up the river, they spawn, and then they leave. And as a result of the spawning, there's going to be millions, you know, if not billions, of juvenile alewives. And everything eats them. Eagles, ospreys, you know, otters, smallmouth bass, largemouth bass, you name it. And then in the Kennebec River, they opened that dam up. It's been over 20 years now. For the first time in decades, where the Kennebec dumps into the Atlantic Ocean, they've actually seen schools of codfish, which hasn't been seen for decades. And in some of the other rivers in Maine, the St. George River, they say that the smallmouth bass are so full of juvenile alewives that they've got fins and fishtails sticking out of their mouths and big fat pot bellies from eating so much juvenile alewives.
And, oh my goodness.
For the first time in you know, that people can remember, the Kennebec River, the ospreys and the eagles aren't fighting over the same fish because there's so much fish there. I think they had a run of several million last year. And it's only, you think about the number of fish that used to migrate up the river. We're only at about 2% of the carrying capacity of the watersheds in Maine, if you can imagine that.
That's unbelievable. That's such, all of that is good news. Thank you, Brian. Yep. This is Esther Ann. I'm your co-host. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU. The time is now 29 minutes past the hour. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change here in the Dawnland.
And we are here with our guests, Brian Altaveda and Olivia Moore. I loved hearing the stories, the hopeful stories of the fish coming back, and I keep thinking about this restoration and the relationships. And so, you know, that fabulous work that's being done in decommissioning these dams and continuing to be a voice for the fish, you know, it's enabling the fish to restore their relationship to their ancestral river. So I really like that, you know, that the relationship isn't always about the human relationship
as well. Let's see. I wanted to ask Olivia. I've heard Olivia talk in the past about how her work has been inspired by Maine Wabanaki Reach. And so I wondered, Olivia, if you wanted to share a little bit more about that. How has your work been inspired by Maine Wabanaki Reach?
Yes, I'm really happy to. So I'm picturing a big circle, and I'm trying to think about where on the circle to begin talking. So with the work of Eastern Woodlands Rematriation, as we're undertaking this work to restore Indigenous food systems, so while we're undertaking projects that, you know, that are supportive of what it means to have our Indigenous food systems intact, so that what the like concrete things, but it's also the how. When we're thinking about rematriating our Indigenous food systems, it's the how, it's the relationality. And I feel like for me, a lot of that really deep understanding and appreciation of the necessity of relationships and how work, all community organizing work and social change work is undertaken has really been shaped, yes, by Maine Wabanaki Reach and also the mentors that have shaped me in my life who also happen to be members of Maine Wabanaki Reach. So some of my really key mentors in life being Esther Ann and Maria Gerard and Penthea Burns and Denise Altivator, also key people in the incredible work of Maine Wabanaki Reach. So I have been really fortunate to have been shaped by my mentors, and I've really grown in my own understanding of how we support healing and change, and that truth comes first within that, right? And so starting from a place of truth. So a specific way that I feel like I kind of look back to is in thinking about Maine Wabanaki Reach, supporting the Maine Truth and Reconciliation Commission process. And so the necessity of within that, looking at the Maine child welfare system and the impact on Wabanaki communities, and so the need to address truth and to give space and opportunity and acknowledgement for those truths of Wabanaki people, but also non-Native people, being involved in these systems and the harms that we're experiencing and continue to be. So that journey of exploring truth. But I really appreciated this point in the process when the folks who are what's now Maine Wabanaki Reach really recognize that, okay, if we are asking Wabanaki people to come forward and to speak these truths that perhaps they've never put words to, don't have all the adequate words to, that there's such immense isolation and pain connected to this, we also need to be really intentional about supporting their healing and that ongoing process, and really seeing them as whole beings and not just the what of like, okay, we need to check box, get as many statements gathered as possible. We need the facts, the facts, the facts. It's this really holistic process of supporting relationships and healing in that really deep, meaningful way. And so that was sort of a really, again, I was fairly, you know, young being connected to that process, but it was really formative and really thinking meaningfully about what is the impact of the work that we're doing and how we're doing the work. And I absolutely carry that in all of the ways that I organize and absolutely in the work with Eastern Woodlands Rematriation. So that's the short version of the impact. So it's, yes, the main Wabanaki reach, but it's also the beautiful human beings who have come together to create this powerful change agent space that is now known as Main Wabanaki Reach.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. It always makes me feel hopeful, you know,
well,
to hear these sorts of stories. And you are doing such amazing work right now for your community. And, to hear those roots and to, you know, what was the air beneath your wings, you know, I really appreciate that story.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for asking. I'm glad that if I hadn't spoken, I haven't spoken those words in that way together, but I want you all to know and to hear and to feel my appreciation. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to share that.
Wonderful. I wonder if we want to spend some time talking about some current projects. Let's see, when we first decided to have this conversation around food and food security and decolonizing our diets, we wanted to, we were first sort of inspired because, you know, coming right up for Penobscot is the planting moon, Kigani Gizo is the planting moon, and so we were thinking about planting and about gardens, but as our conversation illustrates, there's so much more to that topic of food as medicine and decolonizing our diets. There's so much more than just planting or gardening. There's the traditional medicinal knowledges, and it's the healthy fisheries. So I know right now there's some current projects that you both are working on, and I wonder if you wanted to talk a little bit about that. Brian, I was really intrigued about your plans to bring back some traditional seeds. Did you want to talk a little bit about that project?
Yeah, thank you, Maria. This is Brian again. A lot of the ideas that I got actually came from members of the REACH program. So they certainly didn't come from me. I remember when I first started working on a bunch of us, mostly Eddie Bassett and I, when we wanted to help and restore the St. Croix River watershed, I was really astounded as to how little I knew about the river. And the same thing goes for gardening. I'm astounded as to how little I know about gardening. So fortunately, Maria being one of them, and there, I have other friends locally that have been gardening and farming for decades. So I pick their brains and I talk to them and stuff. And so I got a hold of Professor Fred Wiseman. He's an Abenaki from the Burlington, Vermont area. And he has a number of seeds, from different plants and vegetables that's indigenous to this area. From beans to squash to pumpkin, corn, you name it. And so, they rototilled yesterday and we got a few areas marked off. The American Friends Service that my wife works for and Sienna Dana, they're going to help me with some kids, and we're going to plant some of these indigenous seeds. And, I'm really excited about it because it's more than just planting a garden, knowing that our people harvested, farmed these and, planted them for thousands of years gives it a lot more meaning. And I think it was Heather Augustine, made the recommendation of giving some of those seeds to some of the prisons, because, you know, I do prison work. I do teaching circles, talking circles, and been doing sweat lodge ceremonies, you know, throughout the Maine prison system for the last 14 years. And so, you know, a lot of people are excited to get these hands on these seeds and see how they turn out. And what we'd like to do this fall, again, it depends on COVID-19. You know, we'd like to have, when we have a harvest, we want to invite the elders and of all the things that we've grown. And along with that, we want to have some, you know, fish and shellfish and stuff like that, and just have a big feast, you know. And I'm really thrilled about doing that. And, you know, I'm getting all kinds of help from people. As a matter of fact, I probably have more people that want to take the seeds and plant that and help out than, you know, I possibly can get my hands on as far as the seeds go. So, you know, I'm very, you know, I'm very enthused and thrilled about doing that, and we'll see how it works out.
Brian, that's
that
so
sounds
exciting.
Wonderful. Don't forget to invite us when you have that feast.
No problem.
That this is Esther Ann, one of your co-hosts here on Dawnland Signals. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change in the Dawnland. And we just heard from Brian Altavader, one of our guests today, and I was just so excited moving in my seat here when I was listening to you talk about the young people planting those seeds, because I happened to be able to sit in on language class today with Dwayne Toma and learned a new word in our language, Passamaquoddy, and it's Olda Gwagon ceremony. And it just, you know, and I've been trying to think of trying to view things more in ceremony, and I just wonder about, it's just a beautiful ceremony of those kids, those young people planting those seeds, and I get excited thinking about, you know, projects where we could document that and preserve that and have elders tell stories, and so my mind's just going. But thank you so much for that, Brian.
So you are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU. I am your co-host, Maria Gerard, along with co-host Esther Ann. And we are talking with Brian Altavader and Olivia Moore. I wanted to just take a minute. Olivia, I do want to get to your current projects as well. But while Brian was mentioning some folks, I also wanted to sort of brainstorm the different food initiatives that are happening in tribal communities, because this is a very active area of work. And so in addition to Eastern Woodlands, there's also, Brian mentioned the American Friends Service Committee, Wabanaki Programs, and they have also in the past collaborated with REACH on some planting projects at Pleasant Point. There's also the Indian Township Food Pantry and Gardens, which is spearheaded by Janet Lola. And also the school at Indian Township is doing some wonderful work. They're growing food and gardens and creating garden-related curriculum. They have a community garden, Three Sisters Garden, a greenhouse, orchard, and Indian Township School was recently recognized by the Maine Environmental Education Alliance as the School of the Year for their dedication to sustainable food sovereignty initiatives. And so there's a lot of exciting things going on. Micmac Farms has been several years in the making. There's the Passamaquoddy Wild Blueberry Company, right? What other food initiatives can we think of? I just wanted to kind of give a landscape of this sort of work that's going on in our communities. Anyone else got any others to share that I may have
Garden. Well, oh, the People's Garden on Indian Island is another one. That's been, I think, 9 seasons now that has been operating.
Yeah, and in the work that we're supporting, we're specifically supporting Indigenous food producers in trying to support their capacity to be able to do more, because we know our food producers are often very isolated and resources are very, very limited. So that's a big part of the work that Eastern Woodlands Rematriation does, is that we both support existing projects that are community-based, community-reflective, or Indigenous food producers, and we also initiate new projects as well.
Nice. I also wanted to mention also that Nibizen is ramping up their food production and their farm initiative, and recently received many, many, many fruit trees for their project. So there's a lot of wonderful things going on. And Olivia, you've also been sharing through Eastern Woodlands Rematriation.
Yeah, sharing out seeds, seedlings, perennial plants, foods, medicines, trees as well, and helping to plant them and get them established, especially really focusing on what we refer to as community cultivation sites, right? So these places where they can have there's stronger community access, and also creating some new community cultivation sites as well, especially around traditional medicines. So yeah, we've been hustling, working really hard to be responsive to, because of COVID-19, the increased needs, like the needs that have already, you know, we're already disproportionate in our tribal communities prior to the pandemic. And then the pandemic just stressed all of the challenges that already exist within society, both within our food systems, our health systems, but also in social structures and social processes in our communities. So just really ramping up so that we can be responsive to food needs, medicine access needs. So one of the sort of really responsive, I mean, a lot of what we're doing, we were doing prior to COVID-19. We're just bringing a new, deeper level of invigoration because of the necessity, but also because there's new energy and recognition of the need for our traditional ways and food systems in this moment. So it's an important moment that we can potentially use for transformation in this time. So it's really important, one, yes, that we are meeting urgent needs, and two, that we are doing everything we can to create, to help this energy be energy that is transformative in the direction of healing of our relationship to the land and one another in this time. So one of the things that Eastern Woodlands Rematriation put in place because of COVID-19 and the self-isolation is that we've been doing a community care webinar series every Wednesday evening. And so we alternate it sort of between a discussion talking circle format and then alternate 1 week talking circle format, and then the following is a traditional medicine teaching with Dr. Jaspreet Giamarino, who is the lead, the head instructor of our Wabanaki herbalism apprenticeship. And so that's been really a really important way for people to come together, to be connected, for us to continue to transmit important cultural knowledge and to continue to build and to build work and community in this time of physical distance. If I could, I would love to share some about, because Brian and Maria have both kind of touched on the need for our, you know, the res- the restoration of our medicines and of our healers and of our healing practices. So one of the really key projects in Wabanaki territory, the Eastern Woodlands Rematriation supports, is the development of a Wabanaki community herbal apothecary. And so within that, we're really right now the apothecary as very decentralized and seeing our trained, we have a cohort of 12 Wabanaki folks who have been committed this past year to undertaking an herbalism apprenticeship. And really it's around traditional medicine. So it's just as much spirituality as it is Western medicine, maybe even more so. It's beautiful and it is incredible ceremony. And so we have these apprentices who are being trained. We're ramping up for year two of that apprenticeship for a deeper level of knowledge and application. We spend a lot of time on the land throughout various parts of our traditional territories, spending time, yes, on the reservation so people can know what are medicines right, you know, on their daily walk, in their yard, you know, what's really accessible there and knowing medicines around them, but also spending time in other parts of our traditional territory that through the reservation system, our identity has in a lot of ways become really narrowly identified with our reservations. But our territory is so much broader. So we're really intentional about taking time and getting to know other really important parts of our territory where there's significant traditional medicines there. And you know, they hold different power in different parts of our territory within the medicine. So we do a lot of wild harvesting, gathering, making medicine, you know, gathering those teachings, but also sharing medicine out within the community. And all of the activities of the apprenticeship, though we have dedicated apprentices, all of those teachings are and sessions are open to all of our Wabanaki community members. So it's not exclusive and only for, you know, the 12 apprentices that have committed to this process. We also we have a lot of work going on around we have some key again community cultivation sites, a couple other leads on projects here in the state of Maine. Kessie Waters Kimball, who is Mi'kmaq. We also have Karen Martin, who is Abenaki descendant, and then myself, Olivia. I have a small homestead botanical sanctuary in development of important traditional medicine that are harvested, shared out within our network of Indigenous medicine knowledge keepers. We also are doing a lot of work around developing agreements with private landowners for access and harvesting. We have some really powerful work that maybe in the future we'll be able to share more depth about, but some rightful return of land occurring. And so looking at what it means to rematriate land within colonial constructs of land holding, which has been a really powerful journey so far together. We also include a lot of political education in the work that we're doing. We're a very anti-capitalist organization. We very much see capitalism, extraction, exploitation as a key component that collectively in global solidarity needs to be attended to, I'll say politely, if we are ever to decolonize, rematriate, live in balance, period.
I was just gonna interrupt to say that it just sounds like such interesting work and so necessary. And I love, you know, the references so much in what you're saying about sharing, you know, because that seems to be synonymous with this sort of lifestyle, is the giving and the sharing, the growing and the feeding. Mm-hmm. So I can really appreciate that. Now, we just have a few more minutes left,
And so I just wanted to check back in and see if you folks have any closing thoughts. I'll start with Brian. Any closing thoughts for us today, Brian?
Yeah, you know, when we talk about traditional medicine, I mean, we've had it for thousands of years. We've had medicine people, you know, within our communities. You know, I'm not suggesting that we replace Western medicine. I'm talking, you know, that our traditional medicine can work in conjunction with, Western medicine. I'll tell you a quick story. We were in Big Cove. We were in Eel River Bar in New Brunswick. And my wife was really sick. And so during the ceremony, I asked the person that was conducting it, I says, you know, she's really sick. I don't know what's going on with her. He says, are you heading home? You know, it was about 2 a.m, 3 a.m. Are you heading right home after the ceremony? I said, yeah. He says, well, her gallbladder is acting up and needs to be taken out. And so we headed right home. We hit the health center about 8 o'clock, and 3 days later, her gallbladder got removed. Now, you know, another real quick story. The Navajos years ago were having people die of the Hanta virus. The Hanta virus is transmitted by the feces of rodents. And so again, it was a medicine people working with IHS officials that found out what was causing this, and they were able to stop it. So, you know, some people might want to say, okay, I want traditional medicine over Western medicine. But what I'm saying is it's an individual thing. And a lot of times they could both complement each other. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that you pick one over the other. It's a personal thing. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. And thank you, Brian, Olivia, for being our guests on today's show. Thank you for listening to Dawnland Signals today. I'm your co-host, Maria Gerard.
And I'm your co-host, Esther Ann.
Be sure to join us next month, where the topic will be revisiting the Truth and Reconciliation Commission after 5 years. Please stay tuned for the upcoming radio show, Radioactive. Thank you.